Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Sudan is descending into death and destruction at an unprecedented speed, but desperately needed humanitarian funding does not meet the scale of the emergency, UN Chief Antonio Guterres warned on Monday. Addressing donors at a pledging event in Geneva convened by the UN with Egypt, Germany, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, the African Union and the European Union, Mr. Guterres said that out of the $3 billion needed to assist people in Sudan and those who have fled to neighboring countries, less than 17% has been funded so far. More than half the country's population needs aid, and 2 million have been displaced by the fighting since the 15th of April. The UN Secretary General insisted that it was the international community's duty to support the people of Sudan and its neighboring countries. He also condemned violence against aid workers and the looting of humanitarian supplies, appealing to the warring parties to protect civilians and enable humanitarian action in line with international law. A lack of strong cooperation with the international human rights system leaves states adrift, UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk said on Monday, as he addressed rights emergencies in dozens of countries, including Iran, Mali, and Russia. Here he is speaking to the Human Rights Council, which opened its 53rd regular session in Geneva this week.
We are now at a critical juncture. 75 years after the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and 30 years after the Vienna Declaration. Against the backdrop of flaring conflicts, the Sustainable Development Agenda dangerously off track, and environmental harm threatening humanity, international cooperation is vital so that we can advance human rights.
Human rights must always be above the fray of politics, Mr. Turk insisted, following a request from Mali for the UN to immediately withdraw its peacekeeping mission from the country. He called on Russia to cooperate with the council-appointed Independent International Commission of Inquiry on Ukraine and expressed concern over the massive recent increase in executions of prisoners in Iran and the dismantling of human rights principles for women and girls in Afghanistan. Also speaking at the Human Rights Council on Monday, UN Special Rapporteur on Afghanistan, Richard Bennett, said that the Taliban rulers of the country may be responsible for gender apartheid. Europe has been warming twice as fast as the global average since the 1980s, with extreme weather causing excess deaths and economic disruption. That's the key message of the UN World Meteorological Agency, WMO's, latest report. It shows that last year Europe was approximately 2.3 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial average used as a baseline for the Paris Agreement, which aims to limit warming to 1.5 degrees. Last summer was also the warmest on record in Europe. But there is a ray of hope. WMO said that for the first time ever in 2022, renewable energy such as wind and solar power generated more of the European Union's electricity than polluting fossil fuels. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
Blog Talk Radio.
If you wish to survive, you need to cultivate a strong mental attitude.
You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life. There's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me.
You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to...
Radio for Kansas.
You have to let it all go. Fear, doubt, and disbelief. Free your mind.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County, Kansas. Your one true voice in Kansas. This is Radio Free Kansas.
That's right, that's right. Radio Free Kansas. I'm your host, Mike Cadell. Hey, are you pay attention to the news this morning? Hunter Biden pled guilty, and it looks like he's going to end up doing a few years of probation, and I guess he's going to walk. I don't think he's going to have any prison time. Biden, Mr. Biden Jr., what a Hunter. Hunter is has a sugar daddy in Hollywood, I guess, who's evidently paid his back due taxes for it. That's amazing stuff. It really is. Oh, my God. Well, you know, the elite have their advantages, you know. Tap somebody and pay my tax bills. I understand it was about $2 million. $2 million. I don't know if my audio is that good. I have an air conditioner running here in the little office that I occupy. So I apologize if there's some background noise. I pled guilty. Yeah, the dude got off easy, man. No kidding. Well, as you know, it is Tuesday. This can't be happening. And this can't be happening Tuesdays with John Grant in the second hour. And all kinds of fun stuff in the first. I'm feeling pretty good today. And John, in the second, will join me, and we're going to have a great talk about a new article that came out in The Nation magazine. We're going to talk about that, at least that one. And then, of course, the conversation, you know, where, you know, I mean, who knows where it'll go. I mean, it's this can be happening Tuesday. And John Grant in the second hour. Let's see. We got to do something here. We got to do a little bit of fun here. Tristan is not at the switchboard today, as normal. On our summer hours, he is usually right there with me, but not today. So he's running around doing car things, you know, getting cars fixed, that kind of stuff. Okay, and we are lucky. I got us the latest Democracy Now! Headlines this morning. So you don't, you know, if you had to run out the door and didn't get them and didn't see the Democracy Now! Headlines, you have them now. And I'll be back with you.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has wrapped up a two-day trip to China. On Monday, he met with Chinese President Xi Jinping in Beijing for half an hour, as both sides expressed a desire to stabilize relations to relieve soaring tensions between the world powers. Blinken also met with China's top foreign affairs official, Wang Yi, who urged the United States to stop hyping up the threat posed by China. Blinken is the first U.S. Secretary of State to visit China since 2018. This is Chinese President Xi Jinping.
State-to-state interaction should always be based on mutual respect and sincerity. I hope that through this visit, Mr. Secretary, you will make more positive contributions to stabilizing China's U.S. relations.
After the talks concluded, Antony Blinken spoke to reporters in Beijing.
In every meeting, I stress that direct engagement and sustained communication at senior levels is the best way to responsibly manage our differences and ensure that competition does not veer into conflict. And I heard the same from my Chinese counterparts. We both agree on the need to stabilize our relationship.
Six Palestinians were killed and another 90 injured during a massive Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank Monday. The dead included a 15-year-old Palestinian boy. At least one Palestinian journalist was shot and injured. During the raid, which was met by fierce resistance, Israel deployed U.S.-made Apache helicopter gunships for the first time inside the West Bank in nearly 20 years. The raid came a day after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government agreed to accelerate the process for approving new settlements in the West Bank, despite criticism from the United Nations, European Union, and the United States. More than 3,000 people have died in Sudan over the past 2 months since fighting began between rival military factions, this according to Sudan's health minister. A new 72-hour ceasefire began Sunday, a day after an airstrike in the capital Khartoum killed 17, including 5 children. Meanwhile, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has expressed alarm about the deteriorating situation in West Darfur.
I am particularly concerned by reports of gender-based and sexual violence and by the ethnic dimension of the violence in Jenina. Targeted attacks against civilians based on their ethnic identities could amount to crimes against humanity.
In news from Uganda, around 42 people, including 37 students, were killed on Friday in an attack on a school located near Uganda's border with the Democratic Republic of Congo. The children and teens were between the ages of 13 and 18. Ugandan authorities have blamed the attack on the Allied Democratic Forces, a group with ties to the Islamic State based in the DRC. 6 students are believed to have been abducted. A group of African leaders have met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in Kyiv and Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow to push for an end to the Ukraine war. This is South African President Cyril Ramaphosa speaking in Moscow.
And we are here to communicate a very clear message that we would like this war to be ended.
The presidents of Senegal, Zambia, and Comoros, as well as top envoys from Egypt, Uganda, and the Republic of Congo, also took part in the talks. Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg died Friday at the age of 92, just months after being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Ellsberg risked his life in prison by copying and then leaking 7,000 pages of top-secret documents outlining the obscured history of the U.S. war in Vietnam. The leak helped take down President Nixon and the war in Vietnam and led to a major victory for press freedom. Ellsberg would go on to become deeply involved in the anti-war and anti-nuclear movements. He also inspired a new generation of whistleblowers. We'll spend the hour remembering Dan Ellsberg in his own words after headlines. The Justice Department has accused the Minneapolis Police Department of disproportionately targeting Black and Native American people and frequently using excessive and unlawful use of force. The findings come in an investigation launched after the police murder of George Floyd in May 2020. Attorney General Merrick Garland spoke Friday.
The patterns and practices we observed made what happened to George Floyd possible. As one city leader told us, quote, these systemic issues didn't just occur on May 25th, 2020. There were instances like that that were being reported by the community long before that.
The Washington Post is reporting the Justice Department and the FBI waited more than a year before opening a probe into the role played by former President Donald Trump and his top associates in the January 6th insurrection and efforts to overturn the 2020 election. According to the Washington Post, a top deputy to FBI Director Christopher Wray quashed a plan early on to directly investigate Trump. Attorney General Merrick Garland supported the FBI's decision to focus on individuals who raided the Capitol instead of Trump and his associates. Meanwhile, Donald Trump appeared on Fox News Monday and talked about being arraigned on federal felony charges for mishandling classified documents. During the interview, Trump appeared to admit he did not comply with requests to return classified documents. He was interviewed by Fox's Brett Baer.
And it all, why not just hand them over then?
Because I had boxes. I want to go through the boxes and get all my personal things out. I don't want to hand that over to NARA yet. And I was very busy, as you've sort of seen.
Yeah, but according to the indictment, you then tell this aide to move to other locations after telling your lawyers to say you'd fully complied with the subpoena when you hadn't.
But before I send boxes over, I have to take all of my things out. These boxes were interspersed with all sorts of things.
The Gun Violence Archive reports there were at least 19 mass shootings over the long weekend in the United States. At least 12 people died, more than 100 were injured across the country. In Willowbrook, Illinois, one person died, 22 were hurt in a shooting in the parking lot of a mall during a Juneteenth celebration. In Washington state, two people were shot dead. Three were injured at a campground near a music festival. Meanwhile, in St. Louis, Missouri, a 17-year-old was shot dead. Another 11 teenagers were wounded at a party. In health news, the Associated Press reports 1.5 million people have been dropped from Medicaid in recent months as states begin to purge the rolls after the lifting of a pandemic-era rule on eligibility. The AP said most were dropped for not filling out paperwork. While the number of Medicaid recipients grew by over 20% during the pandemic, analysts estimate as many as 15 million people could lose their coverage over the next year. At least 170 people have died in northern India in a scorching heat wave overwhelming hospitals and morgues in the region. Power outages have left people with no running water, fans, or air conditioners. Temperatures topped 110 degrees Fahrenheit. Other regions of the world were also battered by heat waves in recent days. In Mexico, at least 8 people have died due to the extreme heat. Meanwhile, in the southern United States, at least 6 people were reported dead. Hundreds of thousands faced power outages as temperatures soared in Arizona, Texas, Louisiana, Oklahoma, and Mississippi. Some 30 million people were under excessive heat warnings as the heat also set off a series of tornadoes and storms. Today marks World Refugee Day. According to the United Nations, the number of refugees globally has reached over 35 million. That's 8 million more than a year ago. This comes as concern is growing that as many as 700 people trying to reach Europe may have drowned in last week's shipwreck in Greece. Authorities have recovered 80 bodies, but hundreds more are feared to have drowned. Many of the passengers were from Egypt, Syria, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Palestine. On Monday, Pakistan declared a day of mourning for Pakistanis who drowned. The Greek Coast Guard is facing backlash over its failure to help rescue passengers before the overcrowded fishing boat sank. And United Nations member states have adopted an historic treaty to protect marine life in the high seas as warming ocean temperatures and pollution threaten millions of species. The first-ever agreement will create a special UN body charged with managing conservation of ocean life and establish marine protected areas. The treaty will also establish new rules assessing the environmental impacts of exploitative commercial activities on the ocean, including excessive fishing. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report.
Well, we'll get back to the news in a minute after celebrating Hunter Biden. Well, he didn't get out of jail for free. He had to call up one of his rich buddies. I think it's indicative of the times we live in that so many people with money escape. You know, especially on taxes, I think that's really, really something. Oh, man. Coming up, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the stories news media tell are something different than the facts they report. The facts may say what happened where. The stories tell us who's the hero and who's the villain, how important the fight is, and whether we should care about the ending. It's not always easy to discern, but it's critical, which is why narrative has been taken up as an important tool by folks looking to change the world for the better, in part by changing the stories we tell ourselves and one another. Sonali Kolhatkar is the host and executive producer of the daily radio and TV program Rising Up with Sonali and the racial justice and civil liberties editor at Yes Magazine. Her new book, Rising Up, The Power of Narrative in Pursuing Racial Justice, will be published this month by City Lights. She'll join us this week on the show. That's coming up, but first, a quick look back at some recent press. Not so much surprising, but still depressing, the Wall Street Journal is cheerleading for hurting poor people more than they are already hurt. Some Republicans are upset that they didn't get to use the debt ceiling fight to push through all of the benefit cuts that they hold dear, but the Journal's editorial board wants them to buck up. As Connor Smythe explained for Fair.org, the Journal's board counseled that, quote, one reason the deal is worth passing, the provisions on work and welfare are incremental progress the GOP can build on, close quote. That's because the bill included an expansion of work requirements for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, for adults without a disability or children, raising the maximum age for those subject to work requirements from 49 to 54. The editorial's takeaway, quote, a major difference between the two political parties these days is that most Democrats favor a culture of dependency. The GOP's task, which is popular with voters, is to rebuild a culture of work, close quote. Well, it's an odd statement to make when employment for workers between 25 and 54 is at its highest level in more than two decades, thanks in large part to Democrats' decision to go big in the COVID relief package. It becomes perverse if you consider the utter lack of evidence for the idea that expanding work requirements for food vouchers increases employment in any significant way. As groups like the Center for Economic and Policy Research, among others, have demonstrated, there's no question that the work test reduces access to SNAP food vouchers among vulnerable people, but the best read of the evidence is that it has no impact on employment, or only a very small one. The Journal thinks that's terrific, though it's not enough. Quote, one mistake in the debt deal is that the food stamp work requirement exempts veterans and the homeless. These Americans could perhaps most benefit from the dignity and stability of work, close quote. Let the logic soak in. Allowing people minimal access to food resources is an indulgence that harms them. On the other hand, imposing punitive measures on people, forcing them to prove that they are working a certain amount each month, helps them. Rather than having food guaranteed as a human right, people should be threatened with starvation. That way they're insecure and willing to accept the first job that comes around, no matter how bad the conditions or the pay. Again, this is par for the course at the Journal, which ran a piece in May arguing that, quote, liberals in Washington have long prioritized making the poor comfortable over helping them out of poverty, close quote. But it's still disgusting. And it's logical garbage, because it isn't as though this country cannot afford health care or food. As economist Dean Baker has explained, reducing the pay of just the five highest paid CEOs by half would generate savings equal to the entire SNAP budget. And waste in the financial sector eats up at least six times as much money as the SNAP budget each year. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Most of us have a memory about a time someone judged us based on things they heard about people like us. They couldn't, if only for a moment, see us as an individual because that view was clouded by hundreds of tales they'd heard about people with our skin color or clothing or physical ability. And most of us can also recognize that our vision of people we don't know has been shaped by stories we've been told. It's not a giant leap to see how that can affect our political choices and possibilities. Narrative is a tricky and significant thing, and the subject of a lot of important new work, including that of our guest today. Sonali Kolhatkar is the host and executive producer of the daily radio and TV program Rising Up with Sonali and the racial justice and civil liberties editor at Yes Magazine. Her new book, Rising Up, The Power of Narrative in Pursuing Racial Justice, will be published this month by City Lights. And she joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It's such an honor to be with you, Janine. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. I've been hearing about the importance of narrative in social justice spaces for a few years now. And I want to ask you, or ask you to clarify, because it sounds soft. It sounds like meta-phenomenon, you know? You can think, well, let's change facts on the ground, and then we'll talk about what stories we tell about them. So I want to ask you to just respond, how do we define narrative and how do you situate that within what else needs to happen?
Those are great questions. And it is a new front in organizing. And I'm really glad it is because as a journalist for, you know, a few decades now, I have seen the power of how narrative shifts culture and how culture then shifts policy. We'd like to think, especially on the left, that if there is a wrong that needs to be righted, that all we have to do is make the case to the right people ardently enough and it'll happen. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, it doesn't happen that way. And we find ourselves, especially today, at a time when white supremacy is so resurgent. And so it really was important for me to explore this idea of how our narratives are shaped. And it's kind of a simple thing because it's all around us. As human beings, it is extremely natural for us to have an idea of how our world works based on all of the things that we have been exposed to from childhood. And that is in storytelling, whether it's through mass media, the TV shows we watch and the movies we watch, whether it's in the communities we live in and so the people we interact with, classes we took in school or the college courses we took, all of that shapes our view of the world. And so narrative, this idea that intentional storytelling, which is how I define it, shapes our worldview, is a very important way in which we can fight for a better world. And for journalists like me, that is where I am most comfortable because I engage in narrative work every single day. You know, the mainstream media likes to think that there's this myth of objectivity, but what they're doing is they're bringing in the narratives that they have internalized to every story that they write instead of identifying the narrative or even trying to change the narrative. So we have had racist narratives, narratives promoting racist stereotypes for so many years. In my book, I look through the history of Hollywood. I look at the right-wing shock jocks of the kind that Fair has been analyzing for years and how they've perpetuated racist narratives and kept a nation built on white supremacy, kept that ideology alive in the hearts of far too many Americans. But our nation is changing demographically. And in order to fulfill the promise of democracy, people of color need to be seen as full human beings. And that's where narrative work to upend racist narratives and replace them with racial justice narratives comes in. So a lot of organizations are doing that work. A lot of storytellers are now doing that work. I look at how independent media has offered a counterpoint to mainstream media for years and changed narratives. I look at how Hollywood is being infiltrated by new progressive independent filmmakers of color who are finally getting the space, albeit still not commensurate with population, to tell their own stories and to tell the stories of people of color so that we are seen as full, complex human beings. I delve into critical race theory and college education and upending narratives through storytelling in print and even social media. And finally, face-to-face conversations, how we can really come together as a country. And I don't want to sound too idealistic. As someone who's been looking at social justice issues for many years, in fact, it's been hard to not be too cynical. But in doing the research and writing this book, I found myself really feeling more hopeful, because what's happening is, as the demographic shifts are happening in this country, people of color are finally starting to feel less marginalized by speaking up, speaking out, and rising up, particularly to the title of the book. So that's what I think about as narrative. And I hope your listeners and Americans all around us start to see narrative work as important work that is a critical part of social justice work.
It's really just naming something that's happening all the time. You know, I think that it's undeniable how language and how framing can change opinions. You know, I mean, years ago when I was talking about affirmative action, there was research saying that when you talk to people about affirmative action, they're for it. If you talk to people about preferential treatment, they're against it. And a very basic level, it's about the words we use. It's about the language we use to frame and set up situations that we're talking about. So if we can bring it up to the present day, when you talk to people, and you explore this in the book, about diversity, that's one thing. When you talk about equity, it's about what pictures those words call up in people's brains, and the idea that that is actually important and worth paying attention to.
Yeah, I mean, context matters so much, right? Like, see, take the simple slogan, Black Lives Matter. For the independent media, when we covered this movement when it first started 10 years ago, it was not something that our audiences were jarred by, because our audiences had already been conditioned to understand that Black lives have not mattered in American history. But to an audience that has been exposed only to Fox News, or for that matter, even just CNN, Black Lives Matter, if they really didn't want to accept that the country is white supremacist, sounded like Black folks asking for preferential treatment, as if that term meant Black Lives Matter more than everyone else's. So context matters, history matters, and that's where the independent media comes in. And words matter. So there was a campaign by Color Lines magazine, which I write about in the book,
right,
to pressure media outlets to stop using the word illegal when referring to undocumented immigrants. In fact, so many outlets were, and some still do, refer to undocumented people as illegals, not even illegal people, but illegals, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a dehumanizing term. And when you can dehumanize people, then it justifies treating them as second-class citizens, treating them as less than human. And so changing that language, which at that time was not seen as a really important part of work, but that Color Lines pushed for, did help to change the narrative on seeing undocumented immigrants as people, as human beings, and Associated Press changed their language, and you started to see that culture shifting. It doesn't mean that we've won rights for undocumented folks, but it means that we are on our way to doing so, and we have to keep pushing. So yeah, words matter, and I'm really glad you brought that up. So the I word, as it's been called, right? And so there's so many other words that you can look around. And one of the things I want to do with my book is help readers and listeners identify narrative around them. When you're watching a movie, a Hollywood film, to be able to look at it with a critical mind and say, that's a white supremacist narrative. That's a white savior complex, you know, the common trope that, you know, wow, here's a movie where men have all the speaking parts and women are props, or people of color are props. And it's telling the stories of white folks from white perspectives, because the writers are white, the executive producers are white, and people of color, women who are marginalized in the stories, are marginalized then in our culture as well. So we want people to be able to see those things more clearly for themselves and then commit to changing them.
And to recognize that as much as you might think words are words and reality is reality, there is a way that changing the conversation can actually change the facts on the ground. It's a dialectic, of course, but there is a back and forth between if you're comfortable calling people illegals, you're going to have a certain kind of political conversation, and just to remove that from the conversation does actually have a material effect. I think that's important.
Absolutely. Content shapes culture and culture shapes content. They work hand in hand. And one of the other things that I point out in my book, even though we may not think of it as a narrative around race, I have a whole chapter on it because I feel so strongly about it. It's called copaganda. It's not a phrase that I came up with, but it's a phrase that racial justice activists have used for a long time. And that is mass media narratives that portray police as the good guys. It's something that we see in Hollywood all around us. The police are the good guys. When they do bad things, they are the exception rather than the rule. And, you know, that's a kind of pervasive, insidious cultural bedrock that then lays the foundations for pouring one-fourth to one-third of city budgets into police budgets. And when people say defund the police, what they really mean is take money out of police budgets and put them into the things that actually matter. Hollywood is a huge obstacle to the defund movement because Hollywood continually portrays police as noble, as do-gooders. And so it sounds jarring to those who buy into that narrative to hear defund the police. And if we start to change the culture on it, we can start to change the policy on the ground.
Well, one of the things about the book that I appreciate is the naming of names. So often corporate media or just the broader culture seem to come to an idea and sort of swallow it whole as though they created it. And sadly, writers sometimes too act as though things sprang full grown from their heads. That ignores and erases all of the people, all of the organizations that have been working on those ideas forever. And in your book, you name a lot of people, you name a lot of groups. And it's not just about giving credit where credit is due. It's also about contributing to our understanding of how social change happens. If you don't support the roots, the tree is going to blow over. So naming groups that have been doing this work, naming media organizations, naming social justice organizations, it just seems so important. And it's one of the things that I assume you're doing as a choice in the book.
Absolutely. I mean, look, I've been a broadcast journalist before a print journalist for a long time. And so the way I did journalism was providing a platform for other people to tell their stories in a way that furthered my agenda, which is social justice, and our common agenda, because the people that I interview with, by and large, are social justice warriors. And so, you know, helping to offer them a platform, helping to shape the conversation, to best showcase the important work that they're doing. And so writing a book based on 2 decades of interviewing folks, I absolutely wanted to name the names and showcase and quote from the people that have taught me about this work. It was important for me at the very end of the book to have a list of resources of organizations like FAIR that are doing narrative work, you know, organizations whose work I drew from in writing the book and who I hope will get all of the love that they deserve from readers who can walk away thinking, okay, these are the organizations that I want to look to for understanding narrative work and maybe participating in narrative work. So that is absolutely important. And I'm sure I've left out several, but there are so many. And they're growing in number, which is what I'm really, really excited about, is that there are more and more organizations that are growing in number that are doing narrative work, that are actively incorporating into their day-to-day activism how they can shape the culture. It's not enough anymore to just have a press person or a communications department. So, for example, CHIRLA, the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights in LA, made a film that showcases the work that they're trying to do, humanizing immigrants. And I interviewed Angelica Salas on my show about that film. And I write about it. It's called America's Family. I write about it in the book, how organizations are incorporating narrative work into their actions so that they can change the culture alongside the policy shifting that they're trying to achieve.
Well, I want to talk about Yes Magazine, which I've been reading for years. So much of the content of left or independent media is framed in conflict and framed about the enemy. Here's how the bad guy operates. We need to know this. Oh, here's what the bad guy did today. And it's very important. It's important to know. And at the same time, I so appreciate space given to talking about the people and the places that are day-to-day addressing and resolving the problems that plague us. But what is sometimes called solutions journalism is considered soft or unserious somehow. And I've talked about this with my former colleague Laura Flanders, whose show is about spotlighting people who are making things work, who are solving problems collectively. And I just always think, you know, what's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? I feel that more of media could be given to people who are making it work.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the many reasons why I decided to join Yes Magazine. It is very traumatizing and feeding cynicism to engage in crisis journalism, the disaster journalism. It's something that gets the attraction of people, which is why a lot of journalists do it. It's easy to fuel fear and use fear-based journalism. And indeed, there's so much wrong in the world that you never run out of things to cover that are kind of depressing. Mm-hmm. I found as a journalist, I was experiencing sometimes secondary PTSD because my job was to not look away. My job was to look at the injustices, examine them. When I transitioned to Yes Magazine a couple of years ago, it was with the intention of trying to focus on the things that people are doing that are very concrete and the challenges that they face, but how they are realizing the solutions to the problems of the world, because those solutions have always been there as well. They just haven't gotten the attention they do because they aren't sexy, right? They don't attract the right kind of attention. And beyond peace, love, and understanding, they are very, very concrete solutions. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I just returned from a three-day trip to Atlanta, where Yes Magazine partnered with the Decolonizing Wealth Project on a conference focused on reparations. 20 years ago, reparations for Black folks was seen as a pipe dream, as an idea too radical to be taken seriously. You know, Randall Robinson wrote about it, and then eventually Ta-Nehisi Coates many years later wrote about it, and they helped shift the culture to where the idea of reparations now is not so far-fetched or not seen as so radical. You know, there's congressional legislation around it, and Yes Magazine was there because we were covering all of the people that are helping make reparations a reality. We were talking to the members of the California Task Force on Reparations. We were talking to, you know, folks who are doing narrative work to make reparations possible. And to me, that's not just hopeful. It's essential. If we don't know what we're fighting for, then what are we doing fighting against something, right? It's so important for us to know the end goal that we can realize. X, Y, and Z are trying it out on this side of the country. Maybe this other organization can try a version of that to see the models of what's working so that we can realize our just world. That's essential. And so that's why I love working at Yes.
And then also just internationally, which is something that U.S. media often ignore. We are one world, but corporate news media hide that fact like it's their job. And the world kind of looks like the board in a game of Risk in news media. But if we're looking at other examples and other things that we can look to and people we can be in community with, an international focus is also part of that.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, our corporate journalists have internalized the narrative of national security officials. They've internalized the narrative that it's America versus the rest of the world instead of people in the United States and how they can be similar to or different from or engage with people in other countries, and distancing themselves from the national security considerations of government officials is very, very difficult for mm-hmm. corporate media to do. But yeah, for independent media, for media outlets like Yes Magazine, it's essential because there's so much more that unites us than divides us. Climate change affects all of us. Racism affects all of us. Misogyny and patriarchy affect all of us. The rights of children are important to all of us. And so, yeah, learning from one another is absolutely essential to undermine the injustices perpetrated by power structures, right? And so that bottom-up journalism and the bottom-up activism is where we really need to keep reminding ourselves to focus.
Well, and then finally, it's so important to have spaces where you can have this kind of conversation, where you don't have to agree with everything that's said, you know, but you have to preserve a space to have the conversation, as imperfect as that space may be. So I guess I'll just finally ask you to do whatever shout out you have for independent media and what you hope the book will do in terms of how it lands with folks.
Oh, thank you so much for that. You know, folks can check out my show, risingupwithsonali.com, where I do a weekly broadcast. If you go to risingupwithsonali.com, you can not only see the interviews I do every week, but also more information about the book, where you can get a copy of the book. It's really important. I really hope folks go out and support independent publishers and writers like myself. It's a small, very readable book. It's, I hope, quite inexpensive. I'll be doing a speaking tour throughout the country with a book launch in Berkeley at the Berkeley Public Library on June 28th, which I hope folks can come out to. I have lots of events in Southern California where I'm based, also some in Seattle and Houston coming up. And so I really hope people can come out, have a conversation with me, have a conversation with someone else. Check out yesmagazine.org. And I'm plugging FAIR. Check out FAIR's work, please. You know, it was such a resource for me, and it has been such a resource for me for 20 years. I rely on outlets like FAIR, and no, Janine did not pay me to say that. So please do support your local independent media as well, wherever you are, your local bookstores. It's important that we do that.
Well, we're all in it together. We've been speaking with Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of the daily radio and TV program Rising Up with Sonali, and the racial justice and civil liberties editor at Yes Magazine. Her new book, Rising Up, The Power of Narrative in Pursuing Racial Justice, is out this month from City Lights. Thank you so much, Sonali, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the media watch group FAIR, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Coming up at the top of the hour, John Grant. And we've got a little musical interlude. This is from a series called Boardwalk Empire. You may have seen that. It's still available, I believe, on a live stream, Netflix or Prime. I'm not sure which. But either way, here's a medley of some of the hits done by Nick, I don't know how to pronounce his name exactly, Giordano, I think, and his Nighthawk Orchestra. A lot of these songs, and they were composed, they were taken, they're actual songs from the 20s and the early part of the, right after the turn of the, not of the 20th century into the 20th century, the early 1900s. There's a warehouse full of sheet music that was found, and Vince Giordani and his Nighthawk Orchestra, you know, did the accompaniments, and here we go.
Jimbo, Jimbo, find this little Simba.
soundtrack, and it is Vincent Giordano and the Nighthawk Orchestra. And the sheet music came from a warehouse that was abandoned, and there was piles and piles and piles and piles of sheet music, and a lot of it was from the early 1890s, 1910, 1920. And whoever found this convinced Giordano and his orchestra to, you know, hire vocalists. I don't know who sang this one. And this is a really great one here. I'll play for you in this medley. Well, it's not really a medley. This set of music from Boardwalk Empire. It's a fascinating history to the music. Very little of it was original compositions in terms of a lot of it was done. Here's one called the Sugarfoot Stomp.
You grow tired of it soon.
the Boardwalk Empire sound music track, and Vince Giordano and his Nighthawk Orchestra. Coming up at the top of the hour, I'll put one more on from Boardwalk Empire, and then we'll have John Grant, hopefully, if the phones work, as my grandmother used to say. If the phones work, who's sorry now? This is the last one we'll have before the top of the hour comes. Here we go. lucked out. We got a little true crime talk today. We lucked out and got John Grant on the phone. Out there in Philadelphia, John, are you there?
Yeah.
Are you there? Okay, good, good.
I'm here.
We're lucky. We pulled it off again. My studio engineer, Tristan. Tristan
All right.
had to, well, you know, typical, I don't know, what father knows best, leave it to Beaver, name your black and white. You know, Sunday, I was talking with Tristan about his car, you know, pointed out that, you know, you haven't washed it since you got it. You haven't changed the oil, you know. So he just said, fine,
well,
Dad.
Washing is not so important. Changing the oil, you got to do that now and then.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's all that stuff. So he did the right thing and got on the damn internet, of course, you know, got online, and he's off to some mechanic shed like 30 miles away to get his oil changed on his car. So he's a happy guy. He's punishing me. He's punishing me. He didn't call. Yeah, in a way. Because I love it when he runs the studio. He's the switchboard. He runs the switchboard.
I remember he used to do that. Yeah.
He's more busy. He's more businesslike than I am. I screw up too much. But he's driving down there. I think I don't know if his air conditioner works. It's an old car. And it's like 90 degrees here. Probably going to be the rest of the week. And scorching temperatures.
To go up into the high 80s here in the afternoon. It's very pleasant right now here. Yeah.
No, it's not here. I'm looking at it. Right, it's 87 right now and very humid.
Summer.
I mean,
yeah, summer is here. I guess summer is the 21st. I guess that's the official day of summer.
Oh, I missed that. Yeah, yeah.
June 21st is, like, you know, the summer solstice or whatever the hell it is.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
In an earlier conversation, listeners, I was talking to John Grant. I was telling John that about this the book banning. You know, Ron DeSantis, Florida governor, has been he's been very busy. I think he's successfully intimidated a number of school boards, whatever you want to call it, intimidation, censor books, ban books, as well as a lot of other stuff. I mean, you know, for their public school system. And I was talking with John about this art, the Nation magazine this week, Nation magazine, about this lead cover article. Says what are by Jane Smiley, who I confused with the gorilla woman.
Jane Goodall.
I was thinking of Jane Smiley. That sounds like, you know, that's where my head's at. But the cover article is what are the book banners afraid of? What are the book banners afraid of?
Right.
Some notes
yeah.
on the politics of reading. And John took the lead and went out and check it out. I mean,
I read it several times, and I then purchased her latest book of essays, which is what's it called here? The Questions That Matter Most, and it has a really wonderful essay on Huckleberry Finn. It's titled "Say It Ain't So, Huck," and it's very critical of Huckleberry Finn, which of course. You know, the great critics and Ernest Hemingway and all that have said is the greatest American novel, you know. And, Jane here, who's a novelist, has a Pulitzer Prize for her farm novel called A Thousand Acres, which is basically a modern update in, not in Kansas, but the Midwest somewhere. I'm not sure where it is. But it's basically King Lear. She's taken King Lear and, you know, the daughters and the farm and, you know, there's child abuse and all that kind of stuff. She's updated it. And, you know, it got the Pulitzer Prize, so she's a very serious novelist. And so, you know, she was writing this piece in the nation, which is very good, points out that, you know, it uses a film about the Marquis de Sade as a, you know, as to show some of her points about why things are censored. And basically, she comes down with the idea, and I 100% subscribe to this, I say this often myself, is that it's basically complexity. The people who ban books are terrified of the truth and complexity because it, you know, it upsets them or one thing or another. And, you know, Huckleberry Finn suffers from requests and demands for censorship in the schools, and often that censorship comes from the left in the case of Huckleberry Finn, you know, because of the, you know, the use of the word, I'm going to use it, so if anybody's upset, that's too bad. If they use the word nigger, it must be like 235 times in Huckleberry Finn.
Did she advocate censoring the book or changing the words in the book?
No, no, no. She doesn't talk about censoring the book. No, article on Huckleberry Finn, this Say It Ain't So, Huck, she cannot understand, or unfortunately she understands, and it's rather a negative conclusion, that, you know, the critical, she calls the propaganda era from 1948 to 1960, you know, when all these critics were, after World War II, were setting everything up as, you know, what's great, what's not. And, you know, she's saying that the really powerful novel about racism in America and structural racism and all that kind of stuff is, you know, Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, which was, abused and ridiculed by a lot of these critics. And her point is that, I wrote an op-ed in the Philadelphia Inquirer when my wife ran afoul of a superintendent and a principal because she supported the black parents who did not want their, you know, child to be submitted to a poor teacher's teaching of Huckleberry Finn in ninth grade, where there's maybe two black kids in the class and there's a lot of tittering, like, nigger Jim, you know. And, you know, the black parents says, no, I don't want my kids to be submitted to this. And so I took it on, and I figured my response at first was, you know, my wife took it on and went to and spoke at a superintendent's meeting, which was, you know, unheard of that a teacher would do that. And so I decided, well, you know, this is outrageous. This is an American classic, you know. And so I read it again for the second time, and I said, well, goddamn right, you know, this should not be taught in ninth grade, and should be taught in maybe 12th grade, and it should be taught intelligently, you know, in the context of the book and everything that she's talking about. And her point is, and my point was, that you separate the book into three parts. There's the first part where Jim, you know, and Huck is basically an abused child. His father's a drunk and whatnot. And, you know, he's looking for order in his life. He's tired of all the women folk that he has to deal with. And he, you know, Jim's running, and they bond. And, you know, Huck sees Jim as a man, as a human being, you know, a surrogate father in some ways. Well, that's the first third of the book. You know, at that point, he's stymied. He doesn't know what to do. What have I wrought here? You know, this first third of the book. And so then he puts the book up for 3 years here and a couple years here, and he's trying to figure it out at the same time that he's working on creating his own publishing company so he can make money from this book. And and so he puts it up, and he comes to the confluence narratively with the Ohio River, and he decides, shit, I don't know anything about the Ohio River. This is where Huck should be taking Jim to free him to Illinois and whatnot, right? Well, they get lost in the confluence, and they get drawn on the raft down into, you know, the deep south in the Mississippi, which is what Twain knows about along the river. He knows all the Hannibal, right. Missouri, where he was raised. And so he sends Jim to the absolute worst place that he could, and he then drops the whole theme of that amazing first third of the book, right. where Jim is a man, and he gets the satire along the river of the Duke and the Dauphine and the feuds and all that kind of stuff, and it's funny, it's a satire, it's great. And then the last third is Jim ends up, Tom Sawyer arrives, and as a friend of mine often said, Tom Sawyer is a classic capitalist figure. You know, remember, he gets everybody else to paint the wall, to paint the whitewash,
yeah.
you know, and that sort of stuff. And he comes in, and suddenly Jim is like Step and Fetch It, relegated to a chicken coop as, wow. you know, Huck and Tom figure all
that.
This stuff out. It's embarrassing.
Yeah.
It, you know, the last 12 chapters, she says, is boring. Everybody reads it, oh, my God, this is crap. I can't get through it. Well, and then, of course, Huck Finn decides to get away from the women folk and everything else, and he's going
yeah.
to, quote, light out for the territories, manifest destiny,
right.
West adventure, and
uh-huh.
that's where it's left. Well, her point is that, you know, this is not, I mean, it completely avoids the idea of structural racism, which, of course, Uncle Tom's Cabin
well,
is all about as a tragedy.
Yeah.
And what it says is that Americans, white Americans, in their hearts, they may see individual blacks in a certain circumstance when they're alone as human beings, but they're not going to question or take on in any way, shape, or form the structural racism that is America, you know, and the institution of slavery and all that kind of stuff. And so basically she's saying Huckleberry Finn is declared this, quote, great novel because it avoids the question. It begs the question and establishes simply a sentimental heart thing. That, oh, yeah, he's a nice guy. He's a human and all that. And, boy, she makes a damn good case for it. And so, you know, I sort of got off the Nation piece, but, you know, they're
okay.
related,
I mean,
these two essays. They're very much related, censorship ideas and things like that. so what do you think? You've seen the film Quills, which she cites.
Well, yeah, that's sort of the centerpiece of her argument in the Nation. I think it's the centerpiece
mm-hmm.
in terms of an example,
right.
but I did not know anything. I still don't know much. Well, I'm learning right now,
mm-hmm.
courtesy John Grant. You know,
mm-hmm.
I think that's separate from first
mm-hmm.
off. You know, Huckleberry
right.
Finn was written as a comedy piece, and you've contextualized it more
mm-hmm.
accurately than I can. About the stage
mm-hmm.
in Twain's career
right.
in publishing
right.
and why he would write it in that manner.
Right.
And maybe it's lukewarm. You know, Uncle Tom's Cabin was widely popularized at the same, you know, during that period.
Right.
And I
right.
think if it bleeds, it leads. And at that time, the
mm-hmm.
drama, there's high drama. What do you call it? Flowery language that was used in literature at that time. Twain was
right.
The
well,
at that time,
most
yeah.
novels were written by women. At that time, a lot of novels, put it that way, were written by women. They were, you know, sort of
right.
a soft view and that sort of thing.
Right, and they were yeah. And the feminist movement
right.
was surging like crazy for the
mm-hmm.
even suffrage at that time was going on and. You know, there's any number of women at that time who
mm-hmm.
came out here to Kansas to escape the
yeah Edith
the men,
Wharton
the
and
men,
all that, right?
The men and the slave, the men and the men who treated them like slaves who
mm-hmm.
came out. But the point is, I guess, my point is that if you look at it from the sense of propaganda for a movement, as it,
right.
i.e., abolitionism,
right.
Uncle Tom's Cabin served that purpose to all audiences.
Oh, yeah.
While Mark Twain, absolutely, being a former river pilot and a ne'er-do-well, who who wrote incredibly humorous stories and did it despite a lot of hardship, even
right.
out in the Great West, you know, losing his
right.
fortune several times.
Right.
I mean, you know, this guy was he's an entertainer, you know, and
right.
not a dramatist.
He is a gift for gab. He's a good bullshitter. He's
yeah.
a good storyteller. You know, all that stuff, and it's true. He's
yeah.
You know, he's a really fine writer. There's no question about it. I wouldn't argue with that at all. But the point is,
maybe Smiley, maybe Ms. Smiley, Jane Smiley,
mm-hmm.
steps into this thing about Quill, because I
right.
found Quill one of the most despicable movies I'd ever seen, and I never thought of it. The gross parts. I mean, listeners, if you haven't
right.
seen Quill. John will help me with the names and stuff, but it is
to say the least kinky.
It is very kinky, and it is as far as you can go with an R restricted rating. It's just like I couldn't believe it made it. I mean, this is a story about, if you can imagine this, and John jump in. It's about the Marquis de Sade being in a, I don't know, a velvet padded prison,
right.
and descending into real, make by his own volition, he
right.
keeps writing, and he's, I think he's in prison for his writing in France,
right.
and he's, and the movie is set around his determination to keep writing no matter what
right.
this
right.
The French ruling class at that time were due to him, and it's a right.
Well, this is after the French Revolution
yeah.
and all that turmoil
yeah.
and violence, a lot of violence, and of course
right.
there was the far right, the pampered right, and of course that's
yeah.
where he came from. And of course they imprisoned him, and they imprisoned him in this, and this is true. Obviously
right.
this is fictionalized. Quills is taken from a play. It's taken from
a
play.
Who plays that? Who plays it? That guy was perfect in that role.
Jeffrey Rush, who's Australian. He has Academy Award for something. I forget what it was. But he's a good actor. And, you know, he's playing this very right-wing, you know, decadent sort of
rough.
Character. And because he's a bit of a personality, you know, and people like his smut, that they've given him this sort of fancy little cell, which has some of his furniture, and he can have all his fine clothes and things.
Well, it starts out that way, right.
Yeah, and Kate Winslet is a chambermaid, or she's one of my favorite actresses. Kate Winslet is a chambermaid, and of course she, you know, gets to the point he's very, very nice with her. He doesn't abuse her at all, and he, you know, he gets her to smuggle out his writings, and they're published,
right,
and
yeah.
you know, they're the rage, and you know, he's well, you think of somebody like Jean Genet, you know, I don't know if you know who he is, and you know,
I'm sure nobody in Kansas does either.
Jean
yeah.
Genet is famous. Jean-Paul Sartre sort of elevated him. He was in prison for murder, but he was an overt, you know, homosexual, been through, you know, god awful poverty and horrors and delinquency and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And so he wrote these books, and you know, he clearly said, "Hey, this is who society made. They made me, and I'm not running from it. This is who I am. You know, the society made me, and you know, I'm not shying away from that. I am who I am. You know, and there's a little bit of that, a very different kind of character in the Marquis de Sade, of course."
Oh, yeah.
The Marquis de Sade is in France. There are, you know, a number of
right.
philosophical approaches that see in him you know, honorable things. In fact, in the movie, yeah. As she points out, he's not cruel personally. And you know, he shows no evidence of wanting to abuse Kate Winslet, you know. And in fact, the real cruel and brutal person is the guy played by Michael Caine, who comes in to address this outrageous smut-writing prisoner that they have, you know. And he gets a young wife, and, you know, he abuses the hell out of her.
Oh, I forgot. See, that's the part I missed. I forgot that.
So who's the real cruel person in this?
Right.
He is the official, established, highly respected, you know, doctor who has tons and tons of money and, you know, is culturally, you know, condemning this smut spewing, disgusting person, you know. And, of course, her point is, Desaad is actually writing the truth. You know, he's writing it entertainingly. It's a lot of fucking and all this stuff. But he's writing the truth about what's in the heart and soul of the Michael Caine character, who's the prisoner who's overseeing his imprisonment. You know, he's the warden here in a way. So, you know, it's who's the truth teller and who's the really abusive person here. So, I mean, that's the nature of the play. There's another famous play about exactly the same situation in the prison called Marat/Saad, and it's about Marat is a character, a very famous character during that period, who is, I think he's the one who died suicide, and they have paintings of him and bleeding to death in a tub. Again, it was the insane, and this is what Desaad really, it's a true story apparently, he would start carnival theater pieces amongst the insane. He would get them to play parts, and they'd all, you know, have these performances and this thing, you know, the madhouse of performances. So he was a very artistic. He could, you know, he couldn't stop expressing himself. He was just, you know, and he did it to basically rub people's noses in how disgusting human beings can be.
Yeah, the way
you know what I mean.
The way, yeah, well, the way you describe it, it sounds like the I can't remember, McMurphy from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah, okay. Sure. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. That was the Ken Kesey.
Yeah, right. I wanted
absolutely.
To see, I just want to throw this in. Marat/Saad, or Desaad.
Right.
That is that play. I for people in, outside of Kansas, I saw
right.
a live
oh,
stage play
wow.
performance of it at Kansas
right.
State University in Manhattan, Kansas, it was done in the same spirit, came out in the 60s. It's actually available,
right.
listeners. You can watch
right.
it on YouTube. A film.
It's
version.
The
it
more famous play than Quills. Yeah.
Yeah, it's been around for a long time. It came out in the early late 60s. And Glenda Jackson, who recently died, starred
right.
in the cinematic version of it, which is available on YouTube for free. Listeners, just dig around.
Mm-hmm.
It's and Marat was killed by assassinated. He didn't kill himself. He was killed by a woman that Charlotte. I can't pronounce the last name.
Charenton or something like that. The insane asylum.
Yeah. She got in there and killed him after she got out of the nut house. And it became a big deal in the
right.
in the
okay.
French history. So,
well, obviously,
the real
tumultuous times after the French Revolution, you know, when they...
Right. But the funny thing about the stage play, which is not
mm-hmm.
captured in the movie, is
mm-hmm.
that it really worked. I mean, they ended up with the members of the audience became involved in the outcome and the production of the play itself. People were standing up and saying lines. I couldn't figure out if they were actors or if they were legitimate members of the audience. And that was that revolutionary social dynamic of that play given at the time in the late 60s. So that's,
The 60s, they did a lot of those happenings and that kind of plays. You'd have some of these plays, you know, everybody's naked and they're all a gangster on the stage and running around. You know, there was a period of the sexual revolution where that was
everybody was
hip and groovy.
Take off our clothes and run around in the play. Okay?
Right, in the play,
and
of course.
You go ahead. You take your clothes off, too, okay?
But, and, of course, but Jeffrey Rush, you have to, you know, give him some credit. You know, there's a period in the play where he's just walking around Jaybird naked, you know, frontal nudity and everything. You know, he's just letting it all hang out. This guy is a real thespian trooper, you know.
And
he's playing his part to the max.
I get old school. He's a better man than I, Gunga. I couldn't do it.
But, you know, it's a serious aesthetic performance here, you know, that, you know, here's a guy who can't help but write, and by God, I know that. And here's a guy who, you know, who has written, you know, some smutty stuff. And here, you know, in my case, you know, I published two short stories in Penthouse magazine on Vietnam, and I took the opportunity of being as smutty as I could, and, you know, you know, because prostitution was kind of the theme of one of them. But, you know, there is this idea of truth. I mean, truth and obscenity are not inconsistent with each other. You know, you can establish something that's obscene. You know, the Supreme Court can say it's obscene. You could ban it in Boston and all this kind of stuff. Or ban it in Florida now, you know. And Well, you know, it has her point, and again, back to the Nation article, her point is that what we're talking about here is truth and complexity, human complexity, instead of, you know, getting authoritarian ideas, you know, or biblical ideas or fundamentalist ideas like, no, we don't want complexity. That's going off the rails. We want to stay on the rails, and we want it to be this way and only this way. And if you don't do it that way, we're going to censor you. We're going to put you in jail. We're going to fire you. We're going to do all this kind of crap if you start telling your truth in our context where we don't want your truth. Thank you very much. You know what I mean? And so what she's talking about is these book banners are banning the truth, and the truth in the sense that reality is, human reality is very, very complicated, and there's no way out, you know.
But the complication, does that encompass moral panic? Because these individuals are involved in nothing but xenophobia, and but let's just keep it centered on the people who are wanting to ban these books, I think it's my favorite phrase. It's, they're in a hysteria, a moral panic. They initiate it. Ron DeSantis is doing so quite consciously, and there's all these people who just jump into it. It's like who are the actors? Ron DeSantis is obviously an actor at this. He's a principal or orchestrate director, whatever you want to call it. But he's getting all these people in a state of moral panic. What I'm wondering, how many are making money off that moral panic? Just like
Everybody has a self-interest in it, you know, my way or the highway, you know. But, you know, it's interesting. If you sort of, you know, open your mind a little bit and think about Ron DeSantis, and for, you know, his whole episode as a JAG officer overseeing essentially forms of torture in Guantanamo. And his job was to be in the room. And according to one of the people, you know, the imprisoned in Guantanamo at the time, who's now out and on the radio talking about this, you know, he came to them first and said, look, guys, you know, the inmates, I'm the Jagoffs, I'm the lawyer here, and I'm going to make sure they don't go overboard and hurt you, and, you know, I'm looking out for you. I'm on your side, guys. And then he'd get into the room, and, you know, these guys would see him over there snickering, you know, with the guys that were essentially torturing him. How they were torturing him in that case, one particular case, was these guys were on a hunger strike. You know, this is the only thing they got left, is a hunger strike to protest Guantanamo, which is, as we know, full of all kinds of infractions and moral, you know, civil rights issues and whatnot, because a lot of those people in Guantanamo were simply enemies of somebody that knew the military, and they say, hey, Ahmed over there, he's with ISIS or whatever, and they didn't ask any questions. They just flew him to Guantanamo, and they kept him for 15 years there. So a lot of the abuses, a lot of the inmates in Guantanamo were abused. There's no question about it, you know?
Right.
And so here you got this guy. So if you look at, you loosely look at the fiction, let's call it a fiction, Quills, and you look at the Michael Caine character, well, DeSantis in a way fits in with the DeSantis, with the Michael Caine character. You know, he's the guy that's going to, you know, clean this up, and especially now what he's doing in Florida, it's like my way or the highway. You know, we don't want you to talk about race because you might make Johnny uncomfortable, their little white Johnny, you know. Now, are you concerned that little Ralph here, the black kid, you've been making him uncomfortable for many a long, long time? You know, that didn't seem to bother you, you know. But now that you're talking about race and structural racism and all the things, like James Smiley points out, that in, 1840s, that, you know, Harriet Beecher Stowe raised in Uncle Tom's Cabin, DeSantis is saying, well, you can't raise that because it makes people uncomfortable. Well, you're goddamn right it makes them uncomfortable. That's because the truth hurts sometimes, you know, and especially when you hide it, consistently hide it, and you have a structural, cultural society that enforces the hiding of all this stuff, you know. As I say in the movie, Quill, this guy who writes all this smut, is famous for writing smut now in history. And he's a good writer. That's the thing. He's a very good writer. He does it really, really well. He's only he's not personally, at least in the film, he's not personally doing any sadistic things. He's just simply rubbing the establishment's nose in this stuff, one, and basically, you know, revealing the sorts of things that the character, Michael Caine character, actually does with his brand new wife that he's just contracted from the nuns. You know, they have this young woman who has, you know, lived in a nunnery, and he wants to take her, and he tells his locksmith or carpenter, I want a lock on this door that I can lock from the outside, because I don't want my wife, who was raised in a convent, and, you know, I just bought basically from the nuns, I want her to remain pure and, you know, and virginal for my pleasure. You know, and I'll take my pleasure with her whenever I want and lock her in, you know. And so we're going like, wait a goddamn minute, who's the establishment guy here, and who's the sexual outlaw? You know, it's like, that's the beauty of the movie. It starts raising your question, like, yeah, you know, Jeffrey Rush playing Saddam, or not Saddam, saying hello, but the Marquis de Sade, yeah, you know, he is a twisted fuck. There's no question about it. But, you know, he's writing to reveal things, to unburden himself with them, you know, and whereas the Michael Caine character is keeping it all locked in his room where he's abusing this lovely young woman. You know, it's like who's zooming who, you know? And I enjoyed the movie, as kinky as it was, is. And it's not prurient at all, I don't think.
No, I mean, it's gross.
No,
it's gross.
It's
gross.
It's gross. Yeah, yeah.
It was
honest.
Says, right?
That's the thing. It's honest, you know.
I hate to tell you, listeners, but there's a lot of prisoners today in the United States who write with their excrement, not nearly as articulate. But the thing
right.
is, I mean, there is something to what you're talking about. And Jane Smiley, I'm really glad you read that, because I wanted to hear what you said, because I'm not sure I understand it, but I do know banning some of the books that are on this list on the cover photograph
right.
of the Nation, the current issue of the Nation magazine. They've got The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison.
Right.
The book is gay. The Handmaid's Tale, I've read that. You know, there's a bunch of these, a stack of these books that I have not saw or looked at, but you know, I could see this as junior high stuff. You know, I don't
right.
know. Is it fair? Is it fair to the children, the young ones, I don't know. Maybe there are books now written today that would fit that age group in a sensitive manner, where it would.
Yeah,
be,
there's a young adult publishing. There's a lot of it these days. Yeah.
Yeah, see, I don't know.
Well, you know,
the
question of censorship always was interesting to me, especially when I got involved with my wife in this whole Huckleberry Finn thing, you know,
right,
where
right.
the superintendent of the district, when she got involved with the black parents and Huckleberry Finn, he had her in his office once, and he said, what am I going to do with you? You're destabilizing my district, right?
Oh, God.
And then, of course, she took some crayons that were 12 years old, and they never used them. They had them in the back of the, you know, they needed the space in their cabinet. And she took these old crayons, dried up old crayons, to a black community center. And my wife was, listen to this, my wife was arrested for that. I had to take her to the police to get mugshot and fingerprinted. For criminal theft, they attacked
yeah.
her. I mean, they tried to destroy her. She was a tenured teacher, and the only thing they could do was try to claim moral turpitude but stealing crayons, right?
These
and every
moral
you know, her co-teacher who didn't particularly like her knew that these were in the back of the thing. They'd been there for years. Nobody was using them. They couldn't use them in their curriculum. Nevertheless, they wanted to get rid of Luann because, as he said, you're destabilizing my district by, you know, supporting the black parents. And so I took the thing on. I was on a radio show, Marty Moss Cohen in Philadelphia, talking about it. I wrote an op-ed for the Philadelphia Inquirer. you know, what Jane Smiley's talking about Huckleberry Finn, you know, I weighed into that very significantly. This was, 25 years ago, probably.
Yeah.
You know, so all this is serious stuff. It's like, you know, Huckleberry Finn should be taught in school, 12th grade maybe, but the whole context, the truth of the book should be part of the story because this is American cultural
right.
history, right?
Well,
and
it's
not
yeah.
taught that way. It's taught, in the case of the ninth grade here, it was taught
well,
poorly. You know?
Lazy. It's lazy. They have
lazy.
These guides. I've,
Good word. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen teachers do that. They're uninspired.
Right.
You know, there's all kinds of conditions that they – operate in. I've watched them. I remember growing up in that kind of a
right.
super culture. I don't know what you call it. There are a few teachers that steered. For instance, Catcher in the Rye,
yeah.
Ulysses
right.
by
yeah.
James Joyce. These books were considered banned right. books or dirty books.
Right.
Even by some of the teachers, you know. That immediately made me want to go check it out and see what was so dirty
Look,
about it.
Well, you know, I had one of my memorable teachers was Mrs. McConnell, my 10th grade English teacher in South Dade High School in Florida. She had me and a girl in the class, instead of doing a term paper, I forget what it was, but anyway, she had me read. She made a point of it. She figured I was, you know, I was ripe for this book. You know, she had me read, and this girl had her read A Catcher in the Rye. That it was appropriate for me to read this. So that's why I read it, because my English teacher forced me to read it or asked me to read it. and the idea of censorship always gets me. It's like, okay, you censor Huckleberry Finn. And because, you know, Hemingway and everybody declared it the greatest thing since flush toilet, that anybody who says anything negative about it, wow, you're being somehow unpatriotic here or something.
Right.
When really Smiley's argument is that Huckleberry Finn is basically, you know, running cover for racism. It's saying, they're really human beings. Get them on an island all alone, and you're both running from something. Yeah, you can see identity. You have some in common. This black slave is actually a human being, you know, and I can learn something from them. But that's it, you know. Does Huckleberry Finn in any way address what we now have, of course, as structural racism, which, of course, Ron DeSantis would, censor books and deny that that's even possible, you know. You know, structural racism, you're kidding. You're kidding.
I just wanted to point out that the so-called dirty books, that was what they mm-hmm. were called up until I ran into, like, junior and senior year, and then
right.
in high school, and I was surprised to see that the books were available. They were there in the library, you know, and they weren't banned.
Pretty much out of the bag. This new censorship movement is actually a backlash against the liberation of books, because of Ulysses and all those battles that went on. So now this is a retrograde movement, going back to those days when books could be censored, burned and all that. You know, Nazis burned books. They made a big deal out of it. And, it's not good.
At least
favorite book, Billy Budd, isn't in schools.
Right.
I think Billy Budd should be taught in school. I'd teach it in high school. You know, Billy Budd is a great little novel from Melville. All sorts of things you can talk about and, the culture.
Right.
It's not censorship that's not taught in school. So if you choose not to teach Buck Huckleberry Finn or you choose not to teach something else, that's not censorship as much as it's, what you choose to teach. And so, that's just a fact. Obviously there's many, 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 many thousands of books that aren't taught in college or high school. Yeah. doesn't mean they're censored, though. It just means that, they're not on the curriculum.
I'll bring this up.
Mm-hmm.
Just to add to this, about my theory about moral panic among primarily, not just white people, by the way, it's people who are in power. It's people who have the guns and who think that they're, I guess, some sort of righteousness. There's this thing of what is the word righteousness? You know what I mean? What is it? And there's the biblical hold on. There you go. I have to. Somebody called me in the middle of my show. I had to stop it. This moral righteousness or moral righteousness that developed into moral panic. And I'm going with this bit with what happened over the weekend. It seems to be. On the one hand, you see news media networks like Fox that are going on and about the mass casualties during the Juneteenth celebrations in Chicago and other places. Now, this is not a black holiday now. It's a federal holiday, and and the post office is closed, and basically federal employees are guaranteed a paid holiday, and you know, if you have a good employer, you would too, listeners. Mm-hmm. But here's what. So you hear this broadcast, and then you overlooked is a man named John Martin Taylor. His real first name is Major John Martin Taylor. In Kellogg, Idaho, he's 31 years old, and his neighbors moved in to a two-story apartment. And it's a rather pleasant city if you check out Kellogg. It's a beautiful place, like many places are out here in the Midwest, in Idaho especially. And his wife was upset because she alleged that she took her two daughters out in the backyard of these neighbors that had recently moved in. She said, she claims on Facebook, no less, that she saw this 18-year-old kid / man who just graduated this May from high school standing in the back window, in his bedroom window, masturbating in front of this woman's two daughters who were like, I would say like 10 or 12 years old, maybe 8 to 10 years old. They were playing on the jungle bars, and she said, mommy, look, see, and this is her description on Facebook, and she saw the boy downstairs jacking off in the window. That's what she claims. And so first thing she does, she runs to Facebook. Well, this is before Father's Day. And Dad gets home. This is Father Knows Best in America, 2023.
Right.
On Father's Day, he set up. She turned the boy's family into the cops. The cops come there, and this is a week before, after she sees his pee-pee. And files a formal complaint, tells Dad about it. Father Knows Best, and so the cops don't really do anything. They do pay a call, and they interview the kid. The kid cries. Come to find out, allegedly this boy had done the same thing, masturbated in a classroom in the public school before, you know, sometime in the years before he graduated. So Dad comes home on Father's Day.
Oh, boy.
Set up. The wife is is writing more Facebook posts about how their cops aren't doing anything. My daughters and I were upset, blah, blah, blah. Dad gets his gun, comes home from work, gets his gun, goes downstairs, and he kills the 18-year-old boy and then shoots everyone, kills everybody else in the family, too.
He kills his own family?
He goes next door to
the other family, the kid's family.
The kid's name is Devon Smith. He kills him and then kills the three other members in the family who are in the house. Kills everybody. Excuse me.
Well, that's pretty outrageous.
Well, and then...
Now, you can't... What? I certainly wouldn't advocate 18-year-old boys jerking off, but, in public.
Let me just finish. Yeah. So, within hours after he's massacred this family downstairs, His wife posts an honorific tribute to her dad, and how to the man who's the murderer,
mm-hmm.
and how he's a hero, and he's all of our kids look up to you. It was a drippy tribute to this guy before he's arrested, but a few hours after he killed them all. So eventually he is so the right wing, listen.
Right.
And every ping pong pizza crazy person is out there with their guns going, yes,
I know.
He should have killed the pedophile. He should have killed the pedophile. He should have killed the pedophile.
Unbelievable. Well, listen, you know, I don't know if the kid jerking off is a pedophile or what, but I remember when I was in, I think this was junior high, Redland Junior High School. There was a kid, I think his name was Christopher, who was, he had mental problems. I don't know whether he was he's autistic or what it was.
But
he used to do very, very strange and eccentric things. And one day in Miss DeFreitas's English class, we all suddenly realized at the same moment, Mrs. DeFreitas, I'll never forget the look on her face when she realized what was happening. But Christopher was over there with hands in his pants, whacking off in his his desk, you know, and we're all going, oh, gross. You know?
Gross.
But nobody shot him. You know, I think, what did she do? I think she sent somebody down to get the principal or the dean, and he came and escorted Christopher out. I think they probably took him home and said, I think we need to work on this child and, you know, and his public presentations here. It was not a capital crime when Christopher whacked off in Mr. DeFreitas's English class.
Well, I didn't bring that up.
So,
that,
you know, it's all
context.
It's all, you know, how much can you take about human beings? You know, human beings are messy. They're just always going to be messy.
But Catcher in the Rye, Holden Caulfield, that was one of the big things. That was the big thing in the book, you know.
Well, he wanted to go on a subway and erase all the fuck yous on the wall. I remember that. Yeah. That was his mission. Yeah. Oh, too many fuck yous on the wall. I'm going to erase them all.
So I think there's a problem. I think there's a problem with how Americans perceive literature and books.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, at least Mr. Major John in Kellogg, Idaho, how he interprets Father's Day. And all these people, and this is like the true crime narrative now, because I've been watching a lot of true crime, and I'm thinking, I'm watching this story take off because it has legs, you know. It's Father's Day, the guy matches the family below him. And
well,
it's moral outrage, panic.
Yeah. I mean, is it a capital crime, to use that term, for some poor, misguided, mentally ill or whatever 18-year-old child, you know, is fondling himself in the proximity of children? Now, that should not be encouraged. It should be discouraged in every way possible. But, you know, I would come up short of shooting the whole family. I think it's a little excessive.
Right. After there's a stupid legalistic argument that he might have got away with killing just the guy, Kevin Smith, Devin Smith.
Well, maybe only in Idaho. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, right. That's what I was saying. But here's the joke. It's not a joke, actually. It's true. It adds to what you were saying earlier about your buddy there in grade school. This kid wrote after the cops. I'm being a jerk.
Right.
After the cops came to this guy's house, this jack-off artist's house, okay,
right,
and told mom and dad and shamed him, and he was all upset about it. And he got angry and got on Facebook. Not, I don't know if it's Facebook or another social media.
Uh-huh.
And he wrote this horrible. It was not mean or anything. It was just he didn't know how to spell. You could, right. line of re, there was no line of reason. There were no complete senses. Mm-hmm. There were it was just the guy was obviously semi-functionally illiterate. I mean, he was just
right.
was
well,
terrible.
He probably got some autistic or mental illness of some
right.
sort. You know,
and the parents had said that. The parents told the police that. You know, so I'm just saying that that's what I ran into, and
it's like the old classic flasher with the raincoat, you know, and
think of how
people on the subway whacking off on the subway and all this kind of urban
stuff. We've joked about this forever. Now you're getting
right,
killed.
Right, I know, but it's not a capital crime. You know, it's like, you know, really. I mean, okay, this shouldn't, you know, zip your pants up and cut this out, you know?
John Grant.
All right, Mike.